the holiday in between, lest you forgot exactly what's going on, we'll go over the high points. For your information, by the way, as a result of two of the members of our class, I understand that our classes are now on the web. Mira has been recording, and our webmaster has been putting it on the web.
But we still recommend you actually come. Only if you have to
listen again.
So you can review the previous session. You have two sessions up now, do I understand? So that's an opportunity if you want to, if you're a glutton for punishment, you can have it again. So that's just for your information. How are we doing with our cholent?
Well, it's not made yet.
No, I hope not.
The beans are soaking.
But I'm trying to borrow a 32-quart pot from the caterer. I think I'll have an answer tomorrow.
32 quarts, that looks about the size of this room. Is that about right?
No, it should actually be ample.
It should be.
And in terms of knives, I'm concerned about knives because I think we need at least five to do the chopping. And Kathy Zeiss thinks there may have some unused knives that Yivo that she might be able to.
Yivo's knives. Is Yivo kosher?
Donate.
You know, the whole reason for Yivo is so you could be Jewish without being kosher. You've got to remember that. That's what Yiddish is for all about.
Can you volunteer to help chop?
Yeah, we certainly need a lot of volunteers to do all the detail work. And when do we set a date yet? I mean, a time?
You suggested 1 o'clock.
Okay, then that was a good idea.
is it definitely introductory culinary level?
This is definitely, definitely introductory.
The recipe is the rabbi's recipe, and it really looks delicious.
But skills, you can start like basic.
Oh, yes, it doesn't take... The main thing you have to be able to learn, and you don't already have to know how to do it, is to peel a potato. Now, if you've been in the Army, you probably have had experience. Like, if you haven't been, you come to our Zaru. We teach you.
There's no text when I was road breaking.
Okay. So we need a peeler, too. Or do you... depending upon the level of expertise of the peelers.
Okay, let's see. We should get a sign-up list of people who are coming, and then we'll see who has what and what we need to buy, and we'll get it down.
Well, I'm sure. Would you accept parties, borrowing stuff from parties? I'm sure he'd accommodate us.
Would I accept it? Sure, I'd accept it.
I mean, a loan of a big pot.
The only thing is it's going to be a meat pot, right?
Right. Yeah, everything from
and
there.
Everything is, that's right.
Yeah, that's true. We should have a par pot, ideally. Right. Because that gives more freedom to everybody to have milk and stuff like that, sure. Right. Okay, so that's a limitation. Yeah.
Unless they have a par pot.
I'll ask them.
Okay.
Why don't you email me what you need?
Okay.
Some of their soups are par.
But they told me when I asked the question there about all of their parv things, the Mashgiach says, in Hebrew says, Becheskat Basar. In other words, you have to assume everything is meat. Because since the operation is a meat operation, they even though they may not use any meat in the cooking of a salad, let's say, or a side dish, still it all is with the assumption, because they don't take any care to see that meat doesn't get into anything, or that the pots are not the same pots that are used for the meat cooking. Okay,
and
so he said.
They label their soups that way too.
Excuse me.
They label their soups that way. The containers always say.
Right. Even if it's a parv thing, they say. I don't know what they say.
I don't remember the exact wording, right. But they basically say it's a fleshy product.
Right. Okay. Now. That's the 16th and the 17th of December. Now, we are about to make a transition in the text, but I want to go over the Mishnah on which our discussion has been built. If you want to follow along, it's in the English in 13b6. This is Daf Yud Bet Amud Bet, Yud Gimel Amud Bet. Elu Magalchin B'moed. These are the people who can cut their hair on the Chol HaMoed. Okay? Megalchin, remember, means cut your hair, not what it means in modern Hebrew. These are the ones who can cut their hair on Chol HaMoed, means Chol HaMoed. Chol HaMoed. Haba Mimidinat Hayam, the person who comes from abroad. Umi Beit HaShivya, from a place of captivity. Yotzemi Beit HaAsurim, and somebody who comes out of prison. Vehaminude, a person who's under a ban. Shehitir lo chachamim, whose ban was lifted by the sages. And remember that one of the prohibitions of a person under a ban is that a person under a ban cannot cut his hair. He's required to let his hair grow. So somebody whose ban expired, as it were, either because the time was a fixed time and it expired, or the sages decided then and there that it would expire, that person can cut his hair on Chol HaMoed. V'chein mishunish ala chacham v'hutar, somebody who asks a sage to be free from a vow that he had taken. The vow was a vow of not to cut the hair. And that vow is released on Chol HaMoed. V'hanazir, similarly a Nazirite. Remember, we learned that the Nazirite also is prohibited from cutting his hair. And if a Nazirite 20 days before Chol HaMoed says, I'm going to be a Nazirite, stam nizirut shloshim yom. The basic Nazirite-ship is a 30-day period. The 30 days could end then during Chol HaMoed. And that person, too, is allowed to cut his hair. The Hamitzora, the person who had leprosy and was cured of the leprosy. Well, I'm saying leprosy. It's not really necessarily leprosy, whatever it was, that disease. The disease was cured. A period of time goes by. On the seventh day after the person has been observed as not no longer having the tzara'at, that person has to cut his hair. That person has to cut his hair. Okay? So that's the metzora. Where does it say? V'hametzora, mitumato letorato. The metzora who goes from being ritually impure to pure, cuts his hair. And then similarly, ve'elu mechabsin. We then saw a group of people who as well were allowed to wash their clothes on Chol HaMoed. Okay? Now, who were basically similar to this first group. It was not exactly the same list, but a similar list. So, of course, the thing that is implicit here, which we finally made explicit when we got to the Gemara, was the fact that there is a prohibition against doing these things on Chol HaMoed. Because we didn't really understand to begin with, nor does the Talmud necessarily understand, that there should be such prohibitions on Chol HaMoed. It was not clear to the Talmud, as it is not clear to us, that in fact these are prohibited activities on Chol HaMoed. And you remember we discovered why it was that these matters were prohibited on Chol HaMoed, kedei shelo yikansu laregel kishehin menuvalim. Because we do not want people to enter the regel, the festival, when they're a mess. Okay? When they're slovenly. And so the law was constructed to not allow you to do it after the holiday begins, so that people would be extra conscious of preparing for the holiday to make sure that they begin the holiday looking appropriate for the holiday. Therefore, they would cut their hair before the holiday. Therefore, they would wash their clothes before the holiday. And if we say to them that you're not allowed to do it on Chol HaMoed, all that is a goad to make sure that it gets done before the holiday, which is when it should get done, to make sure you enter the holiday in the right frame of mind and looking decent. Okay? that was what we had learned so far. Then we saw some details after that. We were wondering about what it is to be in a position of being indisposed and unable to do these things, because we saw, for example, that the condition of somebody in prison, right? Somebody who is in prison, even if they get out before the holiday, the assumption was that they wouldn't get a chance to cut their hair, or they'd be depressed and wouldn't feel like cutting their hair. Right, so we made a number of exceptions for these groups of people, either because practically there's no other way to deal with it, like with the Metzorah. The Metzorah, his time comes when he has to cut his hair. He can't cut his hair before. It's just not possible. Right? The person who comes out of prison conceivably might, it's not clear from the Mishnah when he comes out of prison. Maybe he comes out of prison 2 hours before the beginning of Pesach. Okay? Or the person who comes from abroad. We saw that that was an issue too. Okay? Now, all of this, of course, has nothing to do with the subject why you came to this class, which was the laws of mourning. What does this have to do with the laws of mourning? Now, it was to that point that we arrived in our last class, and we are now on 14a. If you're following along in the English, it's 14a4. 14a4. As is the custom in the Gemara will frequently bring up subjects either based on logic, because people are wondering about a special case which was not mentioned so far, or the Gemara also could bring up something that is based on a Baraita. There is another piece of rabbinic material which is concurrent with the Mishnah, which may say something different from the Mishnah, may comment on the Mishnah. You never know. Here on 14a4, in the last two lines of the left column, okay, we're now down toward the bottom of Yud Dalet Amud Aleph, the Gemara says, Amar Shmuel. Okay, Shmuel said. Now Shmuel, remember, is a first generation Amorah. First-generation Amorah. An Amorah is somebody who lives after the editing of the Mishnah in the year 200. Okay? So Shmuel is just after that time, and Shmuel is a Babylonian Amorah. A Babylonian Amorah. So Shmuel says, Katan hanolad b'moed, mutar legaleach b'moed. She'ein lecha beit ha'asurim gadol mizeh. Now, first of all, the language is in Hebrew. The language reads just like a baraita. Realize that Shmuel is a transitional figure, first generation of Amoraim. Okay, so it's not clear. It appears that he's not quoting a baraita, although this sure reads like a baraita. So it seems to have that form, and as well, once it has that form and it comes from Shmuel, it also has authority. It has authority. Maybe that's important. Maybe. We'll see. Amar Shmuel, katana nolad b'moed. A baby, a katana is a baby, who is born on Chol HaMoed. Mutar legaleach b'moed. You can cut that baby's hair on Chol HaMoed. This was something I really needed to know. First of all, how many babies have that much hair that it's a problem with Chol HaMoed? It's a very odd case. This is an odd case that you have here. So here Shmuel brings this. This is a katana nolad b'moed, mutar legalech b'moed. And look at the reasoning. The reasoning is just the logic. I don't think that's a matter of a logic. It's just the formulation of it. She'ein lecha beit ha'asurim gadol mizeh. There is no prison greater than this one, namely the womb. All right? This person certainly didn't have a chance to have a haircut. All right? So in other words, you're reading the case now is a case which is a bizarre case. It's certainly a bizarre case. How often this can actually happen is hard to say. Of course, Rashi, let's take a look at the Rashi for the moment, see if I can find it here. Oh, this is by Rashi, by the way, I'm referring to the manuscript Rashi. For those of you who have not been here before, the Rashi in this Masechet is not Rashi. This is not Rashi, who is the commentator who appears as Rashi. This is what you call pseudo-Rashi. Pseudo-Rashi. The Rashi is printed for the first time in a Talmudic manuscript in the Art School edition that you have. And it's on the inside border. And you can see it's in small print, and it says Rashi Kaf Taf Yud, Ketav Yad, according to the manuscript, the Rashi manuscript. Okay? So the last, or it's actually next to the last line, way on the bottom of the page, in the very, very tiny print, the Ein Lecha Beta Asurin. I forgot my magnifying glass. Ein Lecha Beta Asurin, there is no prison, Gadol Mimei Imo, greater than his mother's womb. Shayasham, where he was, the Anishu Anolad, the child who is born is certainly in a position of having been restricted without it being of his own free will. Okay? He didn't get a haircut. He certainly had no free will. Okay? So the child then is allowed to have the haircut. Now, if I remember the other Rashi, let me see.
It's very similar.
Now, the other Rashi is a little bit different. And Alaba Moed, yes, look at the other Rashi, which is, we said that was Rabbeinu Gershom Me'ora Gola. Okay? Where it says, Katana no Laba Moed. A baby who was born on Chol HaMoed, Velo Sarot Gedolim, and he has literally long hair. Mutar Legalech B'Moed, it is permissible for that person to be if you can cut that person's hair on the moed, Se'ar Rosho Hamitza'aro. Now that's what I wanted to get to. Because his hair is causing him pain.
It's bothering him.
But Litza'er in Alacha means not just bothering. It means that really bothering. It's a real problem. So I translated it as pain. The hair is causing him pain. Wait, has that ever happened?
Not in my experience. I've never heard of a newborn who needed an emergency haircut.
My husband had a situation, but I don't know if it was his hair, where it was wrapped around his toe when he was very young.
Oh, yeah.
And he had to be taken to the hospital because he was just crying uncontrollably for days. And finally they figured it out that he had...
Say this, what do you mean? A stray hair?
Yes, a very, just a strand of hair was tightly wrapped around one of his toes as an infant.
I see.
Usually it's the mother's hair, not the baby. But it still would have to be cut.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
Interesting.
America.
And I've heard of that situation before. It's not uncommon.
Is there any?
Really?
Yes, I've heard of it a couple of times.
Yeah.
Look at that. We found a possibility here. I assumed this was totally impossible. But very interesting. So maybe it could be. Yes.
How do you read the manuscript, Rashi? You have a line right above the one you read. Mm-hmm. He seems to be addressing similarly... the notion of the hair being
causing... The Seo Mitzaro, that's right. I'm sorry, you're absolutely right. He does, the manuscript Rashi also says the same thing. Kagon Oto Seo Shekarim Shaidis. I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know if that's French. It's probably French. Normally, the Rashi, although I shouldn't say that, because the manuscript is Rabbeinu Gershom Me'ora Gola, who is from Mainz. He was German. But it doesn't... They were close. The Jews who lived in the Rhineland may have spoke French, they may have spoke German, so I don't really know for sure.
But that's the actual Rashi.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. So it's definitely French.
Say the word again so we can try
to think
of French.
Shin Yud Yud Dalad Shin. So I don't know whether it's Sin or Shin. And it looks like it would be pronounced Shaydis or Shaydish.
But why put
Shaydash?
Shayd?
I don't know.
His spelling in French is always confusing.
What? His spelling
is the way he uses the letters is.
Well, you know that the.
Even when they explain, even when they write it out in French, sometimes.
Well, you know why Rashi's French is so important. Rashi's French is the only source we have of 11th century French pronunciation.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way to understand how French was pronounced in the 11th century. How could you know? You can't ask a Frenchman. You can't read it from a book,
right.
Because if you read it from a book, you'd read it the way you read it today. The only way you can know is if it's written in a completely different alphabet.
That has stability.
That has continuity, exactly. And that is the case of the Hebrew alphabet. So Rashi's French was written in Hebrew letters, and therefore it's from Rashi that French linguists know how French was pronounced in the 11th century.
What does the word sound like?
That is really.
What is it sound
like? What is this word you're talking about?
Shaydish.
Is that the French word?
Well, it's the way it looks to me, but I don't really know, because if I knew the French, you know, I might realize it was just, you know, just pronouncing it wrong. If I had a little different accent, we'd get it. But none of us really knows that. What?
It's not abbreviation of something?
No, no. That's when Rashi uses that language, which he used here, he says, shikorin, in other words, as they say, as they call. It's a situation, it's probably a condition that's called the following, whatever it is.
There was no Hebrew word for it.
As with many things, I assume when you have medical conditions, it's much more likely that you know what the doctor called it than you know what it was in Babylonian Hebrew. And that's really important, too, because he's trying to convey to his readers who know these things because they're living. You know, and they know the common illnesses of childhood. So it would communicate. But enough said on that. Now, that having been said, I think we have to keep in mind, because you're going to see the development of this, and the development is going to go off in a very, very different direction. I mean, when you read this, your tendency in reading it is to try and figure out logically how it fits into the story so far. I think that may be the wrong way to read it, though, because you'll see what's going to happen. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, now the Gemara, Shmuel has made his statement, okay? We now see what Shmuel says. The Gemara then takes off and has something to say about that. The Gemara says, we now learn that you can cut that baby's hair on the moed, on Chol HaMoed, ba moed in. In Aramaic means Cain in Hebrew. Ba moed Cain, that we derive from Shmuel's statement. And therefore you can infer from that, Meikar Alaho, that before the moed, you would not have been allowed to cut the kid's hair. Would have not have been allowed to cut the kid's hair, right? Right? Because we learned...
If it's medically needed.
Oh, if it were really medically needed, sure. But then they're not interested in that. Don't get hung up on this, because this has nothing to do with what the Gemara is interested in. Okay? It's a setup. It's a setup. Realize that. Okay? So it is simply they're trying to tease out the logic of Shmuel's almost baraita. Okay, look at the baraita again. Katana nolad b'moed, mutar legalech b'moed. Right, if the katan was born on the moed, you can cut his hair on the moed. Alright? And then, meikara, if the katan was born before the moed, it would follow then that you couldn't cut it on the moed. You see the logic? See the logic? Right. If the katan is born on the moed, you can cut his hair. If he's born before the moed, you can't cut his hair. Why not? Because if he's born before the moed, you could have cut the hair before the moed. That's the logic there. Okay? Now, this is the setup. The setup is to take this sort of Maraita, to tease out one logical comment from it, and watch what happens here. Meitiv Rav Pinchas. Rav Pinchas now raises an objection to that inference that we just made. All right, we made an inference, which was a logical inference from Shmuel. And Rav Pinchas raises an objection. And he raises an objection by bringing a quote from the Talmud further on down the road in this chapter, which says the following. Kol elu sha'amru mutar legalech b'moed. All of those people about whom it was said, that it is permissible for them to cut their hair on the moed, mutar, exactly those same people are allowed legalech b'yemei evlo, are allowed to cut their hair when they are mourning. Okay? This seems to be one of these klalim, namely a statement that gives you a general principle. And the general principle is that there is a correlation, apparently an exact correlation, between the exceptions that are the exceptions of haircutting for Chol HaMoed and the exceptions that are exceptions for haircutting for mourning, for the laws of mourning. Okay? Right? That is a general principle that the Gemara is later going to enunciate, which we are finding out now. Now, Rav Pinchas has said this, and look at the practical results of that. Kol elu sha'amru mutar legalech b'moed mutar legalech b'yemei evlo. There's a general principle that says that everyone who is allowed to cut his hair on the moed, every case like that is also allowed to cut his hair when he's a mourner. Okay? That would mean, for example, if a person came from abroad and they found out that they became a mourner on the Chol HaMoed, that person can cut his hair. Normal mourner is not allowed to. Again, that's the assumption here. We'll have to see why, but a normal mourner is not allowed to cut his hair. Here we see that there's an exception made for the person coming from abroad. There's an exception made for the person who is coming out of prison. There's an exception made for the person who is a metzora. All of those are exceptions. Okay? Ha asur legaleach b'moein. Asur legaleach b'mevlo. It would follow from the general principle that we learn. We'll make an inference from that. Ha hare. Asur legalech b'moed. Asur legalech b'me'evlo. A person who is prohibited from cutting his hair on Chol HaMoed would be a person who is prohibited from cutting his hair when he's in mourning. Okay? You following that? All right, we'll say it again. Kol elu perapinchas says that we learn a general principle, and that general principle is that everyone who is an exception to the rule about not being allowed to cut your hair on Chol HaMoed, every one of those exceptions also works when you have a case of mourning. Okay? Every one of the exceptions. Okay? Inference is now going to be drawn from that. Ha, hare, asur legalech b'moed. Therefore, the flip side of that is, a person who cannot cut his hair on Chol HaMoed, right, the whole rest of the world, also can't cut his hair when he's a mourner. Right? We said the exceptions are, and then there's a flip side to that. The ones who have to do it are all the people who are not the exceptions. Right?
Is that fundamentally so different?
That's not getting to it.
No. Okay,
that's good. Let me keep going first. Okay? We have to get to the end of this, and then you'll see where we're going. Okay? So we said these are the exceptions. The exceptions are across the board. If there are exceptions, it means that everybody else is in the other category. Okay? And then he's going to tease it out a little further. Next page. Ve'iamrat katan id bepelugda. And if you say that as far as a baby is concerned, id bepelugda, there is a difference that can be enunciated as far as a baby. Remember, we just said as far as a baby, there is a difference. If the baby was born before the moed, it's one thing. If the baby is born on the moed, it's another thing. Okay? Nimtzeit, it turns out, since there's a difference in the baby between before the moed and the moed, and since we know that situations of the moed are exactly the same as situations of mourning, okay? Therefore, it would also follow that before mourning and after mourning, there'd be a difference for the baby. Remember, because we said all the situations of mourning are exactly the same as the situations of Chol HaMoed. We just learned something about a baby and Chol HaMoed. If all the situations of Chol HaMoed are the same as the situations of mourning, and we say that for a baby, the situations of Chol HaMoed, before the Moed is one thing, after the Moed is another thing, then it must be for the baby also as far as mourning goes, before the mourning begins is one thing, after the mourning begins is another thing. Right? Right? We made a general principle based on our principle. Once we started with our principle that everything is the same for mourning as it is for Chol HaMoed, all of the exceptions are the same exceptions. All the same obligations are the same obligations. Okay? That's what we're starting with. A is equal to B. A is equal to B. All right? Then, if we know something about C, namely a baby, right? And the baby is equal to A because the baby's mourning. Is the baby also has to deal with mourning, right? If the baby is, not mourning, the Chol HaMoed. If the baby is born before Chol HaMoed, one set of circumstances. If the baby is born on Chol HaMoed, another set of circumstances. It would then follow, it's got to be true also for mourning. If the baby is born before the mourning sets in, you could cut the hair. You can't cut the hair. If the baby is born after the mourning sets in, then you can cut the baby's hair, right? It's got to be the same in every case. And the baby has got to fit into those cases. Oh, that may be logical, but it's a big problem. Why? Vahatanya, there's a baraita that says, Mikar'in lekatan miknei agmat nefesh. One rends a baby's garment. Mipnei agmat nefesh. Now, agmat nefesh means sadness, tremendous sadness. But what it means in halacha is something different. It means that you cut a baby's clothes. Or at least here you do. It's not halacha. Lest you think it's halacha. But in this discussion, it's assumed to be the case. When you cut a baby's clothes, you rend a baby's garments for mourning, for agmat nefesh, so that other people will weep. The baby is not going to weep. Okay? Other people, to increase the likelihood that other people will express emotion, you tear a baby's garments. And of course, when a baby's garments are torn, it's very upsetting to see that. You don't want to see that under any circumstances. When you realize that a baby has lost a parent, it's a horrendous thing, okay? That's why, according to this baraita, you cut the baby's clothes. Implied there is the fact that a baby is not included in the laws of mourning. The baby has no obligation to cut clothes. That's where we're going to. Right? If we say that the baby is not obligated to mourn, then the original inference we had out of Shmuel, right? Remember, Shmuel brought us that everything for mourning has got to be the same as for Chol HaMoed. Okay? We are learning that a baby doesn't have to observe mourning. Therefore, it would follow that a baby doesn't have to observe Chol HaMoed. And we just learned a law from Shmuel about the baby observing Chol HaMoed. Doesn't work. Okay? Now you're looking very tired.
How do you know it's only in relation to the loss of a parent? Could it be the loss of
doesn't
a
doesn't make any difference. Whatever it is. Could be. Yes, it could be. It doesn't tell us. Whatever it is. Whatever it is.
So this is interesting because there's an inherent contradiction. If you want to establish a general rule...
Yes.
You can't have difficult to reconcile Shmuel. Is this Shmuel's idea that the laws are parallel, that is to say a baby born before the Moed, you can't cut his hair on the Moed? On the other hand, the baby is not a mourner, so why does it apply to the baby?
It's the question of obligation. Is there any obligation of the baby to mourn? If we start out by saying there are certain obligations a baby has and is free from, all right, on Chol HaMoed, baby's free from those obligations because the baby's like everybody else, can't cut his hair. Baby's free from that if he's born on Chol HaMoed, just like a guy comes out of prison. Okay, so in talking about the baby, we can talk about the baby's, the assumption is the baby has an obligation to observe Chol HaMoed. Because we wouldn't have had to make the distinction if the baby be born before or born during Chol HaMoed. The fact that we have to make that distinction shows us that there's an obligation of a baby to observe Chol HaMoed. Similarly, whoever has an obligation to observe Chol HaMoed has an obligation to observe mourning. But we have a baraita that says a baby has no obligation to observe mourning. So this is a good attack on Shmuel because it just doesn't hold together. It doesn't hold together.
Or the theory is incorrect that Pinchas advances, correct, that there's a parallel,
correct,
universe.
Correct. 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 Okay. Now, yes.
I could see the logic of
Chol HaMoed. HaMoed.
HaMoed. Because you know when it starts. When does mourning, so that essentially you have an opportunity. When does mourning start? You don't know.
Correct. But that doesn't, that your logic is fine. Your logic is fine, but it's not necessarily applicable. Once we have a general principle, not every situation has to fit all of the terms of the general principle. Okay? It could be that this one is slightly different, you know, fits 99 not but not 100 of the characteristics. That's okay once we have general principles. Okay? Remember, this is not being brought apparently to teach us anything about babies, really. It's being brought as an attack on Shmuel's general principle, on Shmuel's principle about babies. Okay, he's just saying, look, from what we know about the laws of mourning, Shmuel, you must be wrong. You must be wrong. It can't be that there's this distinction of before and during the Chol HaMoed as far as babies go. Can't be that distinction. Because we know that the laws of mourning are the same as the laws of Chol HaMoed. And we know that the baby is not obligated to the laws of mourning, therefore the baby couldn't be obligated to the laws of Chol HaMoed.
I guess my point, or my issue is, I understood the logic of one. I don't understand why the laws of mourning, it doesn't seem to me there's a logical...
It doesn't have to be. It's when you have general principles, it just means that at a certain point, one observes that these things in category A or seem to be like the things in category B.
So they don't necessarily run from it.
It's correct. It's not necessarily a logic. They're not built one from the other.
Okay.
Not necessarily so. So that one of the things that we're going to have to ask ourselves, and we will ask ourselves, is that even though we don't necessarily see a logical growth of things, there nonetheless seems to be an awful lot of similarity between these things. And one of the questions which you want to ask even at this stage of the game is, isn't it odd that the laws of Chol HaMoed are like the laws of mourning.
That's what I was going to say, is why should there be anything like the laws of mourning?
Yeah, just imagine that.
Why not? Because there's mourning is a unique situation.
Is to do grooming before and to look nice for the holiday. And not getting a haircut during mourning has nothing to do with
correct.
Being nice.
So, why are they the same?
No relationship whatsoever.
So exactly.
Haircutting and the reason for
exactly.
it.
So I'm saying to you. So what? That's the question that you want to ask. And it's a logical question to ask. As soon as you begin to see these comparisons are made, and in a way they would seem to be so psychologically opposed. You would think that mourning was a sad time, Chol HaMoed is a happy time, and so on. It just doesn't seem to fit. So,
but they're both discrete times.
They are discrete times.
That's the only thing that right now we know.
But that's not enough. I mean, we will expect more. But you will see other things, because realize we've actually seen other comparisons so far. Remember that we have a whole bunch, you'll see these coming up now, the Mitzorah and the Menudeh, the person under the ban. These are groups of people that share common practices. They're not allowed to cut their hair. Now, the Menudeh, the person under a ban, is not necessarily, doesn't have the rule that he can't cut his hair because he was supposed to cut it before. Okay? But nonetheless, he has the same custom. The Mitzorah. Didn't know he was going to be a Mitzorah. All right? So we can't say he should have done it before. So that's not the comparison. Comparison is not how they get into it. Comparison is that, in fact, they have the same roles. And that from the outside, if you look in on this, they have to do the same things. Okay? That's all we need to see at this stage of the game, because we don't know why, and we should just wonder why. Now, it sort of begs for an answer, but this is so far not being discussed. Well, basically, we've just raised the problem. Gemara wants to raise the Gemara will has a whole chapter to deal with this. We're just raising the problem.
But it just seems it's so much more a function than formal logic. I mean, it sounds like a Greek discourse here.
Very much so. It could be, well, let's go on with that. Keep this in mind, that maybe we're dealing just with a game. We're playing a game right now. And maybe that's what's happening at this moment anyway, particularly since we got into it with such an absurd case. You know, an absurd case doesn't make the best law necessarily. But it does have certain good things about it. It wakes you up, makes you pay attention to what's going on. It enables a logical argument to take off. A number of things can happen from a bizarre case. And we just have to see where it's going to go. Look at what happens now with this case. Okay, we've shown that the original assumption raised by Shmuel, we've seen the problems with it, and the Gemara goes on. Mikatani ha'asurim, did the Braita actually say, but those who are prohibited to cut their hair during Chol HaMoed are prohibited to cut their hair during the mourning period? It didn't say that. It said the opposite of it. All right? It only spoke about the people who are permitted, who are the exceptions to the rule. All right? Dilma yesh mehen asur v'yesh mehen mutar. All right? Since the Braita only talked about the ones who are the exceptions, maybe it's not covering all of the possibilities. And therefore, you're sort of teasing too much out of Shmuel's words. Shmuel just said this in a very open way. How much can you really tease out of it? You're teasing too much. Okay? Let's go on. Then we get another version of what Shmuel said. Ameimar ve'itema rav shisha, bereid rav idimat nehache. Ameimar, and some say Rav Shisha, the son of Rav Idi, teach this whole piece in a slightly different way. Amar Shmuel. Shmuel said, Katan mutar legacho b'moed, lo shna lo nolad b'moed, velo shna nolad me'ikara. It appears that this is all Shmuel's statement now. Remember, the first time, it wasn't all Shmuel's statement. Shmuel said the first thing. Then the Gemara started playing with it. Here, the second time around, it appears to all be Shmuel's statement. This is more characteristic of an Amora. It's more characteristic of an Amora to begin to sort of try to deal with the logic of a practice. Amara Pinchas af ananami tanina. He says, we have also learned the following. Kol elu sha'amru mutala galech b'moed, mutala galech b'imei avlo. Everyone who is permissible, who's an exception to the cutting, the laws of hair cutting during Chol HaMoed, is also an exception to cutting of hair during the days of mourning. Ha'asurim legalech b'moed, asurim legalech b'imei avlo. Therefore, the ones who are forbidden on the one would be forbidden on the other. Right? That's the way it's, the argument is built slightly differently. Iyamrat katanasur. Now, if you continue to maintain that a baby is prohibited, nimseit avelut no heget bakatan, it would turn out that a katan, a baby, has the laws of mourning, is obligated to observe the laws of mourning. Vetanya, and we've learned, mikarin lekatan mipnei agmat nefesh. You can tear the baby's clothes for agmat nefesh, not because the baby has any laws of mourning attached to it, but for other reasons. Okay? Amarav Ashi, mikatani ha'asurim. Same conclusion now as the one we just read. Why are you, you know, Shmuel, when he made his original statement, didn't make it in the negative in terms of all the things that were prohibited. He said all the things that were permitted, which is not to say that every opposite is also to be included in that. You can't necessarily assume that the opposite case for every possibility is also going to follow. Okay? But we've discovered one thing.
Well, Shmuel only discusses Chol HaMoed. It's Pinchas who keeps dragging in laws of mourning.
Correct. Correct. The Gemara has done this in order to bring us to where we are now going.
To what?
To where we are now going. Look where the Gemara now is. The Gemara says, Avel eino noheg aveluto beregel, shene'amar besamachta bechagecha. The Gemara now goes into the laws of mourning. Everything that you've seen so far was a transition. This was a literary or a classroom transition. It's much, I don't know if any of you have ever written any music. Sure. It's true when you, it's very true when you write music. One of the most important things you learn in writing music is how to modulate, to go from one thing to another, how to bring in a new tune. You can't just bring in a new tune. You have to figure out a way of getting from the old tune to the new tune. It's true in writing. You have transition sentences. You know, if you suddenly introduce a new subject, basically you need a new chapter. Hopefully there's some, I just read a book, and I didn't read the book, but I was looking at a book today, which I see once in a while, books like this. A fellow who published a book, and there's absolutely no relation between one chapter and the other. And it's clear why, because he published these as separate articles and eventually wanted them to be together. But he tried to give it the sense that there was a relationship. So I would have been happy if he said there was no relationship. Nothing wrong with publishing your articles. It's a perfectly, perfectly fine thing to do. But to play as if one has something to do with the other, those transitions, the reasonable person rejects. What you've just been through is a transition in Gemara music. This is a modulation in the Gemara. The Gemara started out with one subject, and now it is in another subject. And the method of the Gemara doing that apparently was more or less logical. The reason that I didn't want to sit too long on the logic is I'm not sure how important the logic is. The methodology is something that I would call more or less logical. It's certainly not, sometimes you have where they bring a baraita, let's say, and they prove it on the basis of authority alone. This is teasing an idea out of another idea. I'm still not sure whether Shmuel has a baraita or doesn't have a baraita. This Rav Pinchas comes in, and he's got this weirdo case, and the case of a baby, and as soon as you think of a baby and a baby's mourning, and I mean, it just begins to catch you, and it's bizarre. It's got a whole bunch of things, and you know where we are now? We're now in the laws of mourning. That was... It's an eight-tone.
Tone-deaf one.
No, I don't. If you ever listen to these modern composers, John Cage, I once went to a Cage concert where I remember the pianist was playing some Cage, got up from the piano and started going inside the piano and banging around like that. So I figured there's something was wrong. You know, only later did I, you know, someone explained to me this was the score. This is, he was doing what he was supposed to be doing. Now, there is, in all of the worlds of art, if you look at it long enough, you will see everything. And you will see people expressing themselves in the oddest ways, or at least it seems odd if you're not like them. You need a teacher to explain to you, you know, why would they ever make a point in such a way? Okay, there are so many other possibilities. Here the Gemara has done its usual thing. The Gemara usually starts out with something and then it has another thing and it tries to attract your attention and then you end up. You never know where you're going to end up with the Gemara. I mean, in the beginning of, you know, when we're here for an hour and a half, where you start, you never know where you're going to end. And it has... It may end on the subject, it may not end on the subject, it may end with emotionally or intellectually or logically in the same place. You just never know about those things. However, there is always a logic behind it, just the way there is in the mind. I mean, if you read James Joyce, the kind of... of subconscious movement between one subject and another subject, surely in modern literature doesn't have to be justified. That is the way of much modern literature, the stream of consciousness type of exposition. I don't think this is exactly stream of consciousness. It is not that. We've seen that, where you'll have a word, and the word reminds you of another subject, and that has a word that reminds you of another subject. So you make you progress from subject to subject on the basis of common words that we've seen. This is different. This, you had a problem, and the problem was used as a transition, and now we're on to the other subject. Now, there's a great connection between the first subject and the second subject. The connection is that, in fact, there is a similarity or possibly even an identity between the laws of Chol HaMoed and the laws of mourning.
In a roundabout way, all the Gemara is doing is proving, in its own way, a fundamental principle of logic, which is if A, if you say that A sort of implies B, if that which is in the category of those which are permitted in the Moed implies that those who are permitted in Avelos. At first, they suppose, well, that would also imply the negative on the prohibited. But under rules of logic, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So after half a page, by referring to the other Brisa and seeing the impossibility in connection with the application of the laws to the child, they basically prove the principle of logic.
Mm-hmm. And if we get back to, that has left us with an identity between the laws of Moed and the laws of Avelut, right?
At least in the sense of the permitted
Correct. At least we see there's an awful lot of similarity, maybe exactly the same or maybe not. We're not really totally sure, because you're right, it's the permitted and not the forbidden. Correct. We know it doesn't necessarily apply to all the forbidden. My approach to that was just to say that I have the feeling that the logic is being used for another purpose. Yes, you're absolutely right. But I think that the logic is used almost for a literary purpose. It's used as a way of creating a transition between ideas.
Well, yeah, because I mean, the way they get there by applying the laws of Avalus to a child isn't really. I mean, it's kind of a cute discussion there, but it really doesn't disprove the logic.
Correct. And
I mean, they get to the right place, but for a trumped up reason.
Correct, and that's the way the Gemara will sometimes do things, because that's the nature of this kind of study. Okay. Now, where it has gotten us is to our first statement, which is a very basic statement about the laws of mourning. And it immediately connects mourning with Chol HaMoed. And it is, Avel eino noheg aveluto baregel. A person who is mourning does not observe his mourning on the regel. Now, regel is a technical term. I won't translate it all the time because it means one of the pilgrimage festivals. One of the pilgrimage. Regel means foot, and that refers to the regalim, which are the feet or the festivals when you walk up to Jerusalem with your feet. Okay? They are called, therefore, the regalim, and one is referred to as a regel. There are three regalim. Three regalim. One is Pesach, Shavuot, and then Sukkot. Okay, going according to the year as we have it. Okay, so an avel, somebody, and that's an important word to remember, by the way, is the word avel. An avel is somebody who is a mourner. Avelut are the customs or laws of mourning. Okay, so an avel, a mourner, does not observe his mourning, aveluto, his mourning, beregel, on the regel. Shenemar v'samachta b'chagecha, as it says, you shall rejoice on your festival. Then the Gemara goes on. I avelud mi'ikarahu. If his mourning begins before the festival, ateyase, comes a positive commandment, derabim, of the public, a positive commandment which is incumbent on the public, vidache ase diachid, and it supersedes a positive commandment which is incumbent on the individual. The I aveluto dahashtahu. And if his mourning is a mourning that comes now, namely on the regel. All right, somebody dies on the regel. They die on the regel.
Oh, no, but you're not talking about pre-existing.
Oh, that's what we were talking about first.
Oh, now
first,
we're
talking about pre-existing. I aveluto demikara. If the mourning started before the regel, somebody dies 2 days before Pesach. Right? Comes Pesach, cancels the mourning. Pesach cancels the mourning.
Cancels it.
No delay. If you mourn for 1 hour before Pesach, Pesach comes, no more Shiva. Shiva's over.
Shiva's over. It doesn't pick up again.
No way. It cancels. Cancels it. Okay?
Does it cancel all Shlishim or just Shiva?
No, just Shiva.
It hurts the mourners.
The general principle is the law is not focused on the mourner. The law is not focused on the mourner. Because the principle is right here, v'samachta bechagecha, you shall rejoice on your festival. I'll tell you, what is the implication of that? Yeah. You shall rejoice. The community is required to rejoice.
Interesting.
Ate ase the rabbi. Where you have a public commandment to rejoice, and the public is commanded to rejoice, it takes precedent over a private commandment to mourn. And therefore, the public takes precedence over the private. See, this would never be written today. In our world, the private always takes precedence over the public, or nearly always. In this world, the public always, nearly always, not always, but nearly always takes precedence over the private. We'll get into this in greater detail in a moment. But I don't want, let's go a little further. The I avelut, the hashtahu. Okay, if the mourning occurs during Chol HaMoed, the death occurs during Chol HaMoed, lo ate ase di yachid, then the positive commandment of the individual to mourn doesn't come vidache ase derabim and put off or reject the commandment of the community to rejoice. Therefore, if a death occurs on Chol HaMoed, Shiva doesn't begin till afterwards. Shiva does not begin till afterwards.
So it's not canceled.
What?
It would be 7 days too?
It depends.
And the burial?
Burial is immediate. You always have to have a burial immediately.
So burial on Chol HaMoed is permitted?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. You must bury as soon as possible.
If somebody dies in the Chol HaMoed of Pesach, is it delayed or is it... Because the last 2 days of Pesach, or the last day of Pesach, is a festival.
But
the festival, well, the better example is Sukkot. Because Sukkot is clearly, the last days of Sukkot are clearly festivals, right? Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, and certainly Shmini Atzeret, has all the force, is exactly the same in the books as Rosh Hashanah. Right? Rosh Hashanah is not 1 ounce more holy than Shmini Atzeret. Exactly the same. Exactly the same.
If someone dies on Shabbat, you can bury on Shabbat.
No, you can't bury on Shabbat. You cannot bury on Shabbat. You have to wait until Sunday. Okay? And if somebody dies on Friday, you have to wait till... Well, you could do it on Friday. If you can do it before Shabbat, you do it. But you can't do it on Shabbat. In theory, you can't do it on the Chag. You can't do it on the first day of the festival. On any real festival day, you can't do it. The second day of the festival is a question mark, because the second day of the festival doesn't have the same biblical status as does the first day of the festival. The second day of the festival is a rabbinic addition to the biblical festival day.
The diaspora, okay? You mean?
Yes.
Mostly by the diaspora, yes.
Mostly, Israel. Not entirely. Because Israel has one second day Yom Tov. You know which one?
Rosh Hashanah.
Rosh Hashanah, right. Yeah. So that's slightly different. That's just, I don't want to make a blanket statement.
It's one thing. Okay. No, that's not a two day. All right. When you have, if the death took place on Chol HaMoed, do you begin the avail during Chol HaMoed, or everything is delayed? Because I think the Yom Tov terminates it altogether, doesn't it?
Only if it begins. If it begins, the Yom Tov terminates it. If it doesn't begin, the Yom Tov won't terminate it. So that is why if you have a death on Chol HaMoed, mourning does not begin till after the festival is over.
But you bury that person.
Yeah, bury is
late. I want to answer the question. Mourning does not begin till the festival is over, therefore Chol HaMoed doesn't cancel anything. Okay, you start counting, you delay the time of counting and the actual observance. You're not allowed to observe Shiva. So if you haven't observed Shiva, you observe it after the whole festival is over. If you have observed Shiva, then the transition, it's a transition that you can't get out of. Once you make the transition, it's over. Right? So you've made the transition to the festival, it's over. Okay? Once the festival is over, in theory, you've never mourned yet, then you can start mourning. That's the way it works. Yes.
suppose a person had a tragic death. Let's say, you know, an animal killed his wife and children. Yes. Is he able to be the reggae? Is he in a condition to go and function?
Doesn't matter. We're not worried about him so much. We're worried about all the other people. Realize when somebody is sitting Shiva, you have an obligation to visit them. And we do not want to impose that obligation on the community, because the community has the obligation to rejoice. And therefore, the community's positive obligation takes precedence over the individual's positive. They both have positive obligations, but the community's takes precedence.
So the reality would be, once a community got to be of a certain size, you would wind up canceling every festival in practice, because somebody would be mourning.
Mm-hmm. Somebody's always dying. It's always happening.
So, that tension, and of course it would be so inappropriate to be, you know, joyful while simultaneously visiting the mourning. So it's clear that they had to make a real decision about priority.
And keep in mind, too, that they're observing, the assumption is that you're observing the festival.
Right.
Yes.
Because as soon as you begin to make any comparisons to the modern environment, the assumption is you're not observing the So that's why it's often hard for modern people to, you know, what difference does it make? Well, the truth is that thought usually comes out of the mind that's not observing the festival. The mind that observes the festival knows that that is the most sacred thing, and that it's a difficult thing to pull off, in fact, to be able to do that. And therefore, the law supports that. Okay, that's the assumption you have to realize is behind all of this.
Because that's much a commandment. It's not an enjoyment. It's a commandment.
Of course. Now, take a look. I want you to see there are several subtle distinctions that are not made here, but could be made, and that if we think about it a while, we'll want to make them. So I want to see you to see the way in which the Tosafot deal with this at the top of the page. Yud Dalet Amud Bet, the first Tosafot. Now, remember who the Tosafot are. The Tosafot are the students of Rashi, the generation after Rashi. So now we're dealing with French commentators of the 11th century, or the end of the 11th century, the beginning of the 12th century. Okay, Rashi dies in 1105. He dies in 1105. So you're dealing with the end of that century and the beginning of the next, okay? Aseh d'yachid. The general principle that we have is that a positive commandment of the community takes precedence over a positive commandment of the individual. Okay? The Tosafot are now going to analyze what is meant by this. Mashma da'avelut ika aseh d'oraita. It appears to be the assumption that the laws of mourning are a positive commandment of the Torah. That seems to be what the Gemara is assuming, because the Gemara says, the Gemara points to the phrase "Vissamachta bechagecha," right? That's the commandment of the Torah, to rejoice on the festivals. Where is that from? Vissamachta bechagecha. It's given.
Deuteronomy.
Where is it?
14.
Deuteronomy 16:14. Exactly. Deuteronomy 6. So is Deuteronomy in the Torah?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is a command that is of the Torah. If we are going to equate the two and just say that a positive commandment of the community takes precedence over a positive commandment of the individual, the assumption is that those are both positive commandments on the same level of authority. Mm. And you know that there are different levels of authority in Jewish law. One level of authority is the Torah. Another level of authority is the rabbis. Which has more authority?
The Torah
has more authority than the rabbis. So that, in fact, you could have a case where you'd have two positive commandments, one of the Torah and one of the rabbis, and it could be that the difference between the two would be one is from the Torah and one is from the rabbis. So the fact that we've said that this thing from the Torah, which says you shall rejoice on your festivals, that the reason why that takes precedence is because the community takes precedence over the individual, that assumes that they both have the same level of authority. They're both from the Torah. Okay? Okay?
He's saying if that weren't the case, that Gemara could have more easily argued that the commandment from the Torah takes precedence over the commandment from the Rabbana. And since they didn't do that,
well, maybe not, because here the Gemara knows and the Tosafot know that Deuteronomy 16:14 is in the Torah. That's the easy one. It's much more difficult for them to know whether the laws of mourning are in the Torah. Where does the Torah say you should observe the laws of mourning?
Well, we just heard about Abraham this last week.
We also know that
but we didn't see that he said Shiva.
Didn't say Shiva, but it said
no. So maybe he did it differently.
Yeah, no, it's more
Aaron. And maybe even if he did do it.
The death of Aaron and the death of Moses.
Okay, what happens?
The Torah.
Yeah, Aaron,
so what does it say?
30 days.
30 right? days. It doesn't say what they did for 30 days.
30 days.
It doesn't even say they did anything for 7 days.
And it doesn't make it a positive commandment for us.
Correct. And it doesn't say, you shall do this, like thou shalt not steal. Or thou shalt observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy. You know, if it was going to say something like that, it was a clear law of the Torah. It should say something like, thou shalt observe the laws of Shiva. Never says that in the Torah. To realize that the Tosafot are setting us up because they themselves know, and it's going to be a problem that we're going to have to deal with in this Masechet, what is the level of obligation of the laws of mourning? So here it says, the way this argument has been structured, it appears that the Gemara itself is assuming that the laws of Shiva are from the Torah. Okay? Mashma da avelut ika asei dioraita. We can infer from this that the laws of avelut, of mourning, are from the Torah. Midaloka marvedache ase de rabbanon, because the argument is not based on the Torah takes precedence over the rabbis. Right, that's what you are saying, but the problem is that it's switched around, really. We have a problem here, because the one we know is from the Torah is the second one. It's not the laws of Shiva. Right, it's the laws of v'samachta bechagecha. That's the one we know is from the Torah.
Right, he's saying if Shiva had been derabanan, then the argument would have been much easier. All you would have said, you wouldn't have had to get into yichud or communal.
But the problem would have been the opposite. If Shiva were from Rabbanan, which would take precedence?
The
I see what you're saying. Okay, good. No, you're right. You're right. Good. Very good.
Since the Gemara had noted this lesser argument, it couldn't be that.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Right. It could have stated the argument. Thank you very much. You're right. You're absolutely right. Could have stated the argument simply in terms of the one in the Torah takes precedence over the one of the rabbis. The one in the Torah is from Deuteronomy. This one, we don't know where it's from. This must be rabbinic. And that would have been perfectly fine, and we would have understood that. Since it did say that, since it raised another possibility, that possibility of the community and the individual, all of that assumes that they're on the same level. And the only difference is that one's for the individual and one is for the community. Very good.
Anybody knows when the Chukei Avilut got into place in the Jewish tradition?
Try to think about it. We're going to read about it. That's what we're reading. You're going to see different efforts to figure that out. And then you're going to have to make your own effort too.
In any event, they were not in the Torah.
Well, we now know that it must be in the Torah. We just don't know where.
Well, not necessarily. You got to read the rest of the Torah.
We need the code. You know.
Okay, let's keep.
No, it's got to be in there.
It's only bait and switch. You have to read the rest of the Torah.
Just starts out this way, okay? Behind the kamar le'el lo mibayime avelo derabanan, up above, before the material we're studying. The Gemara actually makes a statement that says, Yemei Avelo de Rabbanan, the days of his mourning are rabbinic.
I got it.
How could that be? To hear the Gemara is assuming that it's from the Torah. But it knows that several pages before it, actually the Gemara makes the statement that it's from the rabbis. All right?
It's just the days.
Hainu asiyat milacha. Oh, in that case, it didn't mean Shiva, but it meant one specific rule of Shiva is from the rabbis. All right? Keep that in mind. When we say that Shiva is from, we could say that Shiva is from the Torah. Are we going to say that all of the laws of Shiva are from the Torah? The Sabbath. The Sabbath is from the Torah. Muktzah on Shabbat, that you can't touch a record, your record player. You can't touch that on Shabbat. That's in the Torah? No, that's a law of the rabbis. So we can have a law of the Torah and laws of the rabbis that are dealing with the same issue. That's what's going on. When before it said something about milacha, about labor being done during Shiva, yes, that is a law of the rabbis. When it mentions Shiva being from the rabbis, it meant as far as some of the details of the law go, but not the basic concept. The basic concept is from the Torah. That's what the Tosafot are concluding now, okay? But the essence of mourning is from the Torah. It is from the Torah. Now the Tosafot goes on and says, or I'll give you another possibility. That's how the Tosafot
they don't cite from the Torah.
What?
They haven't given us a citation.
Oh, no, because that's they want us to read the Talmud.
They want us to read the Talmud.
What about Vayikra, with the references to Aaron?
You'll see about Aaron. Aaron's going to play a big part in this chapter. Okay. But in all of these cases, I forewarn you, none of them is going to be as obvious as thou shalt not steal. All right? Mihu, perhaps, maybe, but Nir Eli, here the Tosafot come through sometimes, and you don't know who is saying this, but Nir Eli means, I think it's more logical to say.
In the first person.
Okay. The Simchata Regel Nami the Rabbanan. Oh. He says, you could also say it, we've been arguing that they're both on the level of the Torah's authority. But we don't have to argue that. Our only issue is that they'd be on the same level of authority. And you could say that the simcha of the regel, the fact that you're supposed to rejoice on the regel, that too is rabbinic. That's rabbinic. But you said it says it in Deuteronomy 16:14. Oh, so we got to go on and it says, when it says that in 16:14 in Deuteronomy, what it is referring to is b'shalmei simcha. That is referring to the sacrifices that you bring. The shlamim of the regel. When you go to the temple in Jerusalem, you don't want to go empty-handed. The Torah says you shall not appear empty-handed. And you go and your family goes, and what do you want to do? You want to have a good time. You want to have a big meal. How do you have a big meal? You have to bring the animal to the temple. They slaughter the animal. Okay? Remember, the temple was a big abattoir. Right? That's where the slaughtering took place. So you go to the temple, the animal is slaughtered, the shechita is done there. You then go home and you have a good meal. You have a good meal. By the way, this reminds me, an aside, since I know some of you took my advice about seeing Ushpizin. I have another movie for you, which will help you understand this piece a little better. Just came out in New York. I saw, I think maybe in the same theaters, I'm not sure. No, maybe different. Called The Syrian Bride, Hakala Hasurit. The Syrian Bride.
Oh, that actually showed last spring at the Israeli Film Festival.
I had seen it last winter in Jerusalem, and it's about the Druze on the Syrian border. It's a wonderful movie, also a very, very good movie. And one of the things that you see in this movie is the way the Druze live. you know, they don't go to a butcher to have a meal. They butcher to have a meal. Namely, you bring a few sheep around, you could take them in the backyard, and you slaughter them. And then you go out and eat. Now, we're not used to that. We're used to packaged foods. The Druze don't have packaged foods. And it's just worthwhile to keep this in mind, you know, how vastly different life in the Middle East was and still is. Still is. That's the way they still live today. Okay? That's the assumption going on here. V'samachta b'chagecha, when the Torah says you shall rejoice on your festivals, the mitzvah of the Torah is that you shall go to Yerushalayim, you shall bring the animal, the shalmei simcha, these are the shlamim, the free will offerings that you bring. You go, you shecht it, and you go and you have a good time with your family. That's what we're talking about. The mitzvah after the destruction of the temple, that you should go to the congregation or Zarua, and that you should have a meal at home. All of that is rabbinic, that the rabbis developed to substitute for the original Torah meaning of V'samachta b'chagecha. So, the Tosafot are saying, in fact, both of these commandments, either they have to be both on the Torah level, or they're both on the rabbinic level. And logic could put them in both places. They could be both on the Torah level, they could be both on the rabbinic level. We have learned from this, not which they're on, but that they both have to be on the same level. Okay? All right. Any questions? Very good. Okay. Now we know the...
Could the rabbinic interpretations ever be challenged?
Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. People do it every day of the week.
No. I mean, those days, could they have been challenged?
What do you think the Talmud is made of? The Talmud is all made of challenges. The Talmud is one big challenge.
I know. So what was the rule they lived by?
It's called the Book of Chutzpah.
That was the problem. When Maimonides finally came in the 12th century and wrote this stuff down, the people nearly killed them. He said, but what are we going to live by? I got to tell the people what they're supposed to do. The rabbis said, don't you tell them what to do.
It was extremely controversial.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, that's original.
All right, the original method was to study the Talmud.
To keep arguing.
And then all decision-making was done local. Right? Like all politics, all decision-making was local. Once you get somebody who publishes a book, then among other things what he does is that he undoes the rabbi in town out of his job. What do we need the local rabbi for? We have Maimonides. You could buy it and look in the book. Right? So it was, people were not happy when he did that.
Wow, that's great.
It was a very unpopular move in a great part of the community. Okay? All right. Now, I'm just going to take one more statement here, just because I want to show you the transition, then I'm going to drop it and we'll get back to it next time. We know that you have to rejoice on the festival. We know that public rejoicing, but I'm not going to go into it. Let me just say a few more words about public rejoicing. We frequently, you know, in the Jewish community, this is an ongoing issue. We had it in this congregation last month.
Yes.
We had a case of this last month. And it's, I find in 90% of the cases, it's a tremendous surprise to people. They're not aware of the laws of Chol HaMoed. And what I try to do when I know that there is a possibility that we're going to have a problem like this is that I talk with people and I just make them aware of these laws because I don't want them to be shocked. People will tend to be shocked because our modern sensibility is so different. Our modern sensibility is, of course, mourning should be more important than everything else. And how could you not mourn? And in addition, it throws a monkey wrench into your life. Just because for practical reasons, it's kind of difficult. You know the psychology of it. You sort of want to get it over with. You want to do it. going to have a job. You're going to have to put off the time you're out of the job. How are you going to go back to your job? You know, while you're not mourning. I mean, it's a very, very odd thing. So, and it's something that most people, frankly, don't know. I mean, now you know a lot. So it's interesting to see as it works out. I mean, in the community, it's, I think, of course, the point of this all is that the community, in fact, does take precedence, and the joy of the festival has to be the community's concern. And that's something that I think it's always important to reflect upon, you know, that a community has to be first concerned about the joys of the festival, about making yentif. And that does not come natural to us. That is not natural. The other things are natural. That's not natural. So it's not a small thing. And I think the general principle is also the way it's been articulated here, and especially the way that Tosafot went through it, that you're dealing with things that are the same level of authority. And as long as that's the case, we see that where there's competition between the community and the individual, the community takes precedence over the individual.
And the implication being that the individual is obligated to participate in the community.
More or less, yes. But there is sympathy for the plight of the individual. When you see a mourner, for example, let's say somebody lost someone during Chol HaMoed, can you say to them, "I'm sorry"? You know, let's follow it through. Mm-hmm. If we say there's no mourning, can you express anything to them? The law is absolutely. You say everything that seems to come naturally. So that you don't want to make a person feel, you know, as if you're not responding to where they are emotionally. All we are saying is, though, that we will not structure the community's life based on that. But on a personal basis, we can respond to the mourner as seems appropriate.
But what about Kaddish?
Kaddish is not, sorry, I take that back. Kaddish is said from the time that the grave is filled in. Therefore, Kaddish starts before Shiva starts. In this case, you say Kaddish at the time of the burial, and then in fact the person says Kaddish from that point on during the festival, even though they haven't yet observed Shiva. It's an odd set of circumstances, but that's in fact what happens.
And what about tearing the clothes?
Does not happen until, well, it depends. That's more complicated. Well, let's wait till we get there.
But that explains a lot about why they start the whole thing with discussing Chol HaMoed. Because the question really is not what should you do, or, you know, rent your clothes and bury it.
That's a good point.
But how much should you take away from your private actions from the requirements of and obligations of the community?
Very nice.
And that should be the entry into the discussion. Mm-hmm. Is because I remember when I looked at the Shulchan Aruch about mourning, the things that I remember were, you shouldn't go to a wedding because, like, you shouldn't put a damper on someone else's chag, because then they'll have to stop rejoicing to tend to you, and that's why you should sort of not go to a party. But that says a lot about how important the party is.
That's exactly right. That's the flip side. That's really, that may not come naturally to us, right. But that's exactly
but
what the
is
focus
that
is.
Is that why they start with the Chol HaMoed?
I think it's an excellent point.
Okay.
Excellent point. Beautiful.
If a community had a disaster, I mean, a lot of people killed, like earthquake or something, and it was Chol HaMoed, what the rabbi will do at that?
Yeah. It's very interesting, because we almost had that situation 9/11. It was a very difficult thing during 9/11 to sort of walk the balance right after 9/11, because remember Rosh Hashanah was about four days later. And it was a very difficult thing because some people made the decision on one extreme or the other. Some rabbis decided to not pay any attention to 9/11 I remember one. We had one specific case in New York where that was, it was a cause célèbre. Congregation went bananas. The rabbi decided that the laws of the Yom Tov take precedence, and we cannot let that interfere. There was exactly the opposite happened as well. Some rabbis decided that this communal tragedy is really, you know, this is a year that we have to just not deal with individual penitence, but deal with the hurt of the community. Those of you who remember, this rabbi was exactly in the middle.
Yeah, I remember.
He was exactly in the middle, trying to figure out
to acknowledge,
but not to not deal with the personal, and to try to create that balance. It was no easy job. It was a very, very difficult time.
I'd say that the lesson I am deriving is that the mourning is really communal.
That's good. That's
and
correct.
That therefore
that's correct.
You have to, we think of mourning as an individual act,
right.
But here the mourning is the communal act.
Uh-huh.
So the community has to be in the proper frame,
mm-hmm.
to in fact participate as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so atomized in our thinking, but the strength of the system is in fact in the community. So that you must have the community.
That goes exactly with what you were saying.
Yeah.
Very good. To be continued.
Can I just make an announcement?
Yes, ma'am.
Is everybody okay with signing up for the cholent making on through email? Or does anybody not have access that way? If I send around an email asking, is that okay? Is
Jay, do you have an up-to-date email for everybody?
Yeah?
Anybody who thinks Jay may not have your email, talk to Jay.
What date is it?
Rabbi.
The
16th. My soul.
Eating, making, right, 16th, eating, and 17th. And my final announcement.